By 1790, people were asked to claim their race on the census. And by 1825, the perceived degrees of blood determined who would be classified as Indian. From the late 1800s through the early 20th century, as waves of immigrants entered the United States, the concept of a white race was solidified. When slavery in the United States was abolished in 1865, whiteness remained profoundly important as legalized racist exclusion and violence against African Americans continued in new forms. To have citizenship and the rights citizenship imbued, you had to be legally classified as white. People with non-white racial classifications began to petition the courts to be reclassified. Now, the courts were in the position to decide who was white and who was not. For example, Armenians won their case to be reclassified as white with the help of a scientific witness who claimed they were scientifically Caucasian. In 1922, the Supreme Court ruled that the Japanese could not be legally white because they were scientifically classified as Mongoloid. A year later, the court stated that Asian Indians were not legally white, even though they were also scientifically classified as Caucasian. To justify these contradictory rulings, the court stated that being white was based on the common understanding of the white man. In other words, people already seen as white got to decide who was white. The metaphor of the United States is the great melting pot, in which immigrants from around the world come together and melt into one unified society through the process of assimilation, is a cherished idea. Once new immigrants learn English and adapt to American culture and customs, they become Americans. In reality, only European immigrants were allowed to melt or assimilate into dominant culture in the 19th and 20th centuries. Because regardless of their ethnic identities, these immigrants were perceived to be white, and thus could belong. Race is a social construction, and thus who is included in the category of white changes over time. As the Italian-American man from my workshop noted, European ethnic groups such as the Irish, Italian, and Polish were excluded in the past. But where they may have been originally divided in terms of origin, European immigrants became racially united through assimilation. This process of assimilation, speaking English, eating American foods, discarding customs that set them apart, reified the perception of American as white. Racial identification in the larger society plays a fundamental role in identity development, in how we see ourselves. If we look white, we are treated as white in society at large. For example, people of Southern European heritage, such as Spanish or Portuguese, or from the former Soviet Union, especially if they are new immigrants or were raised by immigrants, are likely to have a stronger sense of ethnic identity than will someone of the same ethnicity whose ancestors have been here for generations. Yet, although their internal identity may be different, if they pass as white, they will still have a white experience externally. If they look white, the default assumption will be that they are white, and thus they will be responded to as white. The incongruity between their internal ethnic identity, for example, Portuguese, Spanish, and external racial experience, white, would provide a more complex or nuanced sense of identity than that of someone who doesn't have a strong ethnic identity. However, they are still granted white status and the advantages that come with that status. Today, these advantages are also de facto rather than de jure, but are nonetheless powerful in shaping our daily lives. It is on each of us who passes white to identify how these advantages shape us, not to deny them whole scale. Because race is a product of social forces, it has also manifested itself along class lines. Poor and working class people were not always perceived as fully white. In a society that grants fewer opportunities to those not seen as white, economic and racial forces are inseparable. However, poor and working-class whites were eventually granted full entry into whiteness as a way to exploit labor. If poor whites were focused on feeling superior to those below them in status, they were less focused on those above. The poor and working classes, if united across race, could be a powerful force. But racial divisions have served to keep them from organizing against the owning class who profits from their labor. Still, although working class whites experience classism, they aren't also experiencing racism. I grew up in poverty and felt a deep sense of shame about being poor. But I also always knew that I was white, and that it was better to be white. Racism. To understand racism, we need to first distinguish it from mere prejudice and discrimination. Prejudice is prejudgment about another person, based on the social groups to which that person belongs. Prejudice consists of thoughts and feelings, including stereotypes, attitudes, and generalizations that are based on little or no experience, and then are projected onto everyone from that group. Our prejudices tend to be shared because we swim in the same cultural water and absorb the same messages. All humans have prejudice. We cannot avoid it. If I am aware that a social group exists, I will have gained information about that group from the society around me. This information helps me make sense of the group from my cultural framework. People who claim not to be prejudiced are demonstrating a profound lack of self-awareness. Ironically, they are also demonstrating the power of socialization. We have all been taught in schools, through movies, and from family members, teachers, and clergy, that it is important not to be prejudiced. Unfortunately, the prevailing belief that prejudice is bad causes us to deny its unavoidable reality. Prejudice is foundational to understanding white fragility, because suggesting that white people have racial prejudice is perceived as saying that we are bad and should be ashamed. We then feel the need to defend our character, rather than explore the inevitable racial prejudices we have absorbed so that we might change them. In this way, our misunderstanding about what prejudice is protects it. Discrimination is action based on prejudice. These actions include ignoring, exclusion, threats, ridicule, slander, and violence. For example, if hatred is the emotion we feel because of our prejudice, extreme acts of discrimination, such as violence, may follow. These forms of discrimination are generally clear and recognizable. But if what we feel is more subtle, such as mild discomfort, the discrimination is likely to also be subtle, even hard to detect. Most of us can acknowledge that we do feel some unease around certain groups of people, if only a heightened sense of self-consciousness. But this feeling doesn't come naturally. Our unease comes from living separate from a group of people, while simultaneously absorbing incomplete or erroneous information about them. When the prejudice causes me to act differently, I am less relaxed around you, or I avoid interacting with you. I am now discriminating. Prejudice also manifests itself in action, because the way I see the world drives my actions in the world. Everyone has prejudice, and everyone discriminates. Given this reality, inserting the qualifier reverse is nonsensical. When a racial group's collective prejudice is backed up by the power of legal authority and institutional control, it is transformed into racism, a far-reaching system that functions independently from the intentions or self-images of individual actors. J. K. Haolani Kawanui, professor of American Studies and Anthropology at Wesleyan University, explains, "Racism is a structure, not an event. American women's struggle for suffrage illustrates how institutional power transforms prejudice and discrimination into structures of oppression. Everyone has prejudice and discriminates, but structures of oppression go well beyond individuals. While women could be prejudiced and discriminate against men in individual interactions, women as a group could not deny men their civil rights. But men as a group could, and did deny women their civil rights. Men could do so because they controlled all the institutions. Therefore, the only way women could gain suffrage was for men to grant it to them. Women could not grant suffrage to themselves. Similarly, racism, like sexism and other forms of oppression, occurs when a racial group's prejudice is backed by legal authority and institutional control. This authority and control transforms individual prejudices into a far-reaching system that no longer depends on the good intentions of individual actors. It becomes the default of the society and is reproduced automatically. Racism is a system, and I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge the intersection of race and gender in the example of suffrage. White men granted suffrage to women, but only granted full access to white women. Women of color were denied full access until the Voting Rights Act of 1964. The system of racism begins with ideology, which refers to the big ideas that are reinforced throughout society. From birth, we are conditioned into accepting and not questioning these ideas. Ideology is reinforced across society, for example, in schools and textbooks, political speeches, movies, advertising, holiday celebrations, and words and phrases. These ideas are also reinforced through social penalties when someone questions an ideology and through the limited availability of alternative ideas. Ideologies are the frameworks through which we are taught to represent, interpret, understand, and make sense of social existence. Because these ideas are constantly reinforced, they are very hard to avoid believing and internalizing. Examples of ideology in the United States include individualism, the superiority of capitalism as an economic system, and democracy as a political system, consumerism as a desirable lifestyle, and a meritocracy. Anyone can succeed if he or she works hard. The racial ideology that circulates in the United States rationalizes racial hierarchies as the outcome of a natural order, resulting from either genetics or individual effort or talent. Those who don't succeed are just not as naturally capable, deserving, or hardworking. Ideologies that obscure racism as a system of inequality are perhaps the most powerful racial forces, because once we accept our positions within racial hierarchies, these positions seem natural and difficult to question, even when we are disadvantaged by them. In this way, very little external pressure needs to be applied to keep people in their places. Once the rationalizations for inequality are internalized, both sides will uphold the relationship. Racism is deeply embedded in the fabric of our society. It is not limited to a single act or person, nor does it move back and forth, one day benefiting whites and another day, or even era, benefiting people of color. The direction of power between white people and people of color is historic, traditional, and normalized in ideology. Racism differs from individual racial prejudice and racial discrimination in the historical accumulation and ongoing use of institutional power and authority to support the prejudice and to systematically enforce discriminatory behaviors with far-reaching effects. People of color may also hold prejudices and discriminate against white people, but they lack the social and institutional power that transforms their prejudice and discrimination into racism. The impact of their prejudice on whites is temporary and contextual. Whites hold the social and institutional positions in society to infuse their racial prejudice into the laws, policies, practices, and norms of society in a way that people of color do not. A person of color may refuse to wait on me if I enter a shop, but people of color cannot pass legislation that prohibits me and everyone like me from buying a home in a certain neighborhood. People of color may also hold prejudices and discriminate against their own and other groups of color. But this bias ultimately holds them down, and in this way, reinforces the system of racism that still benefits whites. Racism is a society-wide dynamic that occurs at the group level. When I say that only whites can be racist, I mean that in the United States, only whites have the collective social and institutional power and privilege over people of color. People of color do not have this power and privilege over white people. Many whites see racism as a thing of the past, and of course, we are well served not to acknowledge it in the present. Yet racial disparity between whites and people of color continues to exist in every institution across society, and in many cases, is increasing rather than decreasing. Although segregation may make these disparities difficult for whites to see and easy to deny, racial disparities and their effects on overall quality of life have been extensively documented by a wide range of agencies. Among those documenting these challenges are the U.S. Census Bureau, the United Nations, academic groups such as the UCLA Civil Rights Project and the Metropolis Project, and nonprofits such as the NAACP and the Anti-Defamation League. Scholar Marilyn Fry uses the metaphor of a birdcage to describe the interlocking forces of oppression. If you stand close to a birdcage and press your face against the wires, your perception of the bars will disappear, and you will have an almost unobstructed view of the bird. If you turn your head to examine one wire of the cage closely, you will not be able to see the other wires. If your understanding of the cage is based on this myopic view, you may not understand why the bird doesn't just go around the single wire and fly away. You might even assume that the bird liked or chose its place in the cage. But if you stepped back and took a wider view, you would begin to see that the wires come together in an interlocking pattern, a pattern that works to hold the bird firmly in place. It now becomes clear that a network of systematically related barriers surrounds the bird. Taken individually, none of these barriers would be that difficult for the bird to get around. But because they interlock with each other, they thoroughly restrict the bird. While some birds may escape from the cage, most will not. And certainly those that do escape will have to navigate many barriers that birds outside the cage do not. The birdcage metaphor helps us understand why racism can be so hard to see and recognize. We have a limited view. Without recognizing how our position in relation to the bird defines how much of the cage we can see, we rely on single situations, exceptions, and anecdotal evidence for our understanding, rather than on broader interlocking patterns. Although there are always exceptions, the patterns are consistent and well documented. People of color are confined and shaped by forces and barriers that are not accidental, occasional, or avoidable. These forces are systematically related to each other in ways that restrict their movement. Individual whites may be against racism, but they still benefit from a system that privileges whites as a group. David Wellman succinctly summarizes racism as a system of advantage based on race. These advantages are referred to as white privilege, a sociological concept referring to advantages that are taken for granted by whites and that cannot be similarly enjoyed by people of color in the same context. Government, community, workplace, schools, etc. But let me be clear. Stating that racism privileges whites does not mean that individual white people do not struggle or face barriers. It does mean that we do not face the particular barriers of racism. As with prejudice and discrimination, we can remove the qualifier reverse from any discussion of racism. By definition, racism is a deeply embedded historical system of institutional power. It is not fluid and does not change direction simply because a few individuals of color manage to excel. Whiteness as a position of status. Being perceived as white carries more than a mere racial classification. It is a social and institutional status and identity, imbued with legal, political, economic, and social rights and privileges that are denied to others. Reflecting on the social and economic advantages of being classified as white, critical race scholar Cheryl Harris coined the phrase, whiteness as property. Tracing the evolving concept of whiteness across legal history, she explains, by according whiteness an actual legal status, an aspect of identity was converted into an external object of property, moving whiteness from privileged identity to a vested interest. The law's construction of whiteness defined and affirmed critical aspects of identity, who is white, of privilege, what benefits accrue to that status, and of property, what legal entitlements arise from that status. Whiteness, at various times, signifies and is deployed as identity, status, and property, sometimes singularly, sometimes in tandem. Harris's analysis is useful because it shows how identity and perceptions of identity can grant or deny resources. These resources include self-worth, visibility, positive expectations, psychological freedom from the tether of race, freedom of movement, the sense of belonging, and a sense of entitlement to all the above. We might think of whiteness as all the aspects of being white, aspects that go beyond mere physical differences and are related to the meaning and resultant material advantage of being defined as white in society. What is granted, and how it is granted based on that meaning. Instead of the typical focus on how racism hurts people of color, to examine whiteness is to focus on how racism elevates white people. Whiteness rests upon a foundational premise, the definition of whites as the norm or standard for human, and people of color as a deviation from that norm. Whiteness is not acknowledged by white people, and the white reference point is assumed to be universal and is imposed on everyone. White people find it very difficult to think about whiteness as a specific state of being that could have an impact on one's life and perceptions. People of color, including W.E.B. Du Bois and James Baldwin, have been writing about whiteness for decades, if not centuries. These writers urged white people to turn their attention onto themselves, to explore what it means to be white in a society that is so divided by race. For example, in 1946, a French reporter asked expatriate writer Richard Wright his thoughts on the Negro problem in the United States. Wright replied, "There isn't any Negro problem. There is only a white problem." As Wright pointed out, racism against people of color doesn't occur in a vacuum. Yet the idea that racism in the United States can operate outside white people is reinforced through celebrations such as Black History Month, in which we study the Civil War and civil rights eras as if they occurred separately from all U.S. history. In addition to the general way these color-based celebrations take whites out of the equation, there are specific ways that the achievements of people of color are separated from the overall social context and depoliticized, for instance, in stories we tell about Black cultural heroes. The story of Jackie Robinson is a classic example of how whiteness obscures racism by rendering whites, white privilege, and racist institutions invisible. Robinson is often celebrated as the first African American to break the color line and play in Major League Baseball. While Robinson was certainly an amazing baseball player, this storyline depicts him as racially special, a Black man who broke the color line himself. The subtext is that Robinson finally had what it took to play with whites, as if no Black athlete before him was strong enough to compete at that level. Imagine if instead, the story went something like this. Jackie Robinson, the first Black man whites allowed to play Major League Baseball. This version makes a critical distinction because, no matter how fantastic a player Robinson was, he simply could not play in the major leagues if whites, who controlled the institution, did not allow it. Were he to walk onto the field before being granted permission by white owners and policymakers, the police would have removed him. Narratives of racial exceptionality obscure the reality of ongoing institutional white control, while reinforcing the ideologies of individualism and meritocracy. They also do whites a disservice by obscuring the white allies who, behind the scenes, worked hard and long to open the field to African-American players. These allies could serve as much-needed role models for other whites. Although we also need to acknowledge that in the case of the desegregation of baseball, there was an economic incentive for these allies. I am not against Black History Month, but it should be celebrated in a way that doesn't reinforce whiteness. For those who ask why there is no White History Month, the answer illustrates how whiteness works. White history is implied in the absence of its acknowledgement. White history is the norm for history. Thus, our need to qualify that we are speaking about Black history or women's history suggests that these contributions lie outside the norm. Ruth Frankenberg, a premier white scholar in the field of whiteness studies, describes whiteness as multidimensional. These dimensions include a location of structural advantage, a standpoint from which white people look at ourselves, at others, and at society, and a set of cultural practices that are not named or acknowledged. To say that whiteness is a location of structural advantage is to recognize that to be white is to be in a privileged position within society and its institutions, to be seen as an insider, and to be granted the benefits of belonging. This position automatically bestows unearned advantages. Whites control all major institutions of society and set the policies and practices that others must live by. Although rare individual people of color may be inside the circles of power, Colin Powell, Clarence Thomas, Marco Rubio, Barack Obama, they support the status quo and do not challenge racism in any way significant enough to be threatening. Their positions of power do not mean these public figures don't experience racism. Obama endured insults and resistance previously unheard of. But the status quo remains intact. To say that whiteness is a standpoint is to say that a significant aspect of white identity is to see oneself as an individual, outside or innocent of race. Just human. This standpoint views white people and their interests as central to and representative of humanity. Whites also produce and reinforce the dominant narratives of society, such as individualism and meritocracy, and use these narratives to explain the positions of other racial groups. These narratives allow us to congratulate ourselves on our success within the institutions of society and blame others for their lack of success. To say that the whiteness includes a set of cultural practices that are not recognized by white people is to understand racism as a network of norms and actions that consistently create advantage for whites and disadvantage for people of color. These norms and actions include basic rights and benefits of the doubt, purportedly granted to all, but which are actually only consistently afforded to white people. The dimensions of racism benefiting white people are usually invisible to whites. We are unaware of, or do not acknowledge, the meaning of race and its impact on our own lives. Thus, we do not recognize or admit to white privilege and the norms that produce and maintain it. It follows that to name whiteness, much less suggest that it has meaning and grants unearned advantage, will be deeply disconcerting and destabilizing, thus triggering the protective responses of white fragility. White supremacy. When we look back to the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s, we might think of white supremacists as the people we saw in photos and on television, beating blacks at lunch counters, bombing black churches, and screaming at Little Ruby Bridges, the first African-American child to integrate an all-white elementary school in Louisiana in 1960. Today, we might think of the self-described alt-right white nationalists marching with torches in Virginia and shouting blood and soil as they protest the removal of Confederate war memorials. Most white people do not identify with these images of white supremacists, and so take great umbrage to the term being used more broadly. For sociologists and those involved in current racial justice movements, however, white supremacy is a descriptive and useful term to capture the all-encompassing centrality and assumed superiority of people defined and perceived as white, and the practices based on this assumption. White supremacy, in this context, does not refer to individual white people and their individual intentions or actions, but to an overarching political, economic, and social system of domination. Again, racism is a structure, not an event. While hate groups that openly proclaim white superiority do exist, and this term refers to them also, the popular consciousness solely associates white supremacy with these radical groups. This reductive definition obscures the reality of the larger system at work and prevents us from addressing this system. While racism in other cultures exists based on different ideas of which racial group is superior to another, the United States is a global power, and through movies and mass media, corporate culture, advertising, U.S.-owned manufacturing, military presence, historical colonial relations, missionary work, and other means, white supremacy is circulated globally. This powerful ideology promotes the idea of whiteness as the ideal for humanity well beyond the West. White supremacy is especially relevant in countries that have a history of colonialism by Western nations. In his book, The Racial Contract, Charles W. Mills argues that the racial contract is a tacit and sometimes explicit agreement among members of the peoples of Europe to assert, promote, and maintain the ideal of white supremacy in relation to all other people of the world. This agreement is an intentional and integral characteristic of the social contract, underwriting all other social contracts. White supremacy has shaped a system of global European domination. It brings into existence whites and non-whites, full persons and sub-persons. It influences white moral theory and moral psychology, and is imposed on non-whites through ideological conditioning and violence. Mills says that what has usually been taken as the racist exception has really been the rule. What has been taken as the rule, racial equality, has really been the exception. Mills describes white supremacy as the unnamed political system that has made the modern world what it is today. He notes that although white supremacy has shaped Western political thought for hundreds of years, it is never named. In this way, white supremacy is rendered invisible, while other political systems, socialism, capitalism, fascism, are identified and studied. In fact, much of white supremacy's power is drawn from its invisibility. The taken-for-granted aspects that underwrite all other political and social contracts. Mills makes two points that are critical to our understanding of white fragility. First, white supremacy is never acknowledged. Second, we cannot study any sociopolitical system without addressing how that system is mediated by race. The failure to acknowledge white supremacy protects it from examination and holds it in place. In Ta-Nehisi Coates' essay, The Case for Reparations, he makes a similar point. To ignore the fact that one of the oldest republics in the world was erected on a foundation of white supremacy, to pretend that the problems of a dual society are the same as the problems of unregulated capitalism, is to cover the sin of national plunder with the sin of national lying. The lie ignores the fact that reducing American poverty and ending white supremacy are not the same. White supremacy is not merely the work of hot-headed demagogues or a matter of false consciousness, but a force so fundamental to America that it is difficult to imagine the country without it. In light of the reality of historical and continual white supremacy, White complains about reverse racism by programs intended to ameliorate the most basic levels of discrimination are profoundly petty and delusional. As Mills summarizes, both globally and within particular nation states, then white people, Europeans, and their descendants continue to benefit from the racial contract, which creates a world in their cultural image, political states differentially favoring their interests, an economy structured around the racial exploitation of others, and a moral psychology skewed consciously or unconsciously toward privileging them, taking the status quo of differing racial entitlement as normatively legitimate and not to be investigated further. Race scholars use the term white supremacy to describe a socio-political economic system of domination based on racial categories that benefits those defined and perceived as white. This system of structural power privileges, centralizes, and elevates white people as a group. If, for example, we look at the racial breakdown of the people who control our institutions, we see telling numbers in 2016 to 2017. 10 richest Americans, 100% white, 7 of whom are among the 10 richest in the world. U.S. Congress, 90% white. U.S. governors, 96% white. Top military advisors, 100% white. President and vice president, 100% white. U.S. House Freedom Caucus, 99% white. Current U.S. presidential cabinet, 91% white. People who decide which TV shows we see, 93% white. People who decide which books we read, 90% white. People who decide which news is covered, 85% white. People who decide which music is produced, 95% white. People who directed the 100 top-grossing films of all time worldwide, 95% white. Teachers, 82% white. Full-time college professors, 84% white. Owners of men's professional football teams, 97% white. These numbers are not describing minor organizations, nor are these institutions special interest groups. The groups listed above are the most powerful in the country. These numbers are not a matter of good people versus bad people. They represent power and control by a racial group that is in the position to disseminate and protect its own self-image, worldview, and interests across the entire society. One of the most potent ways white supremacy is disseminated is through media representations, which have a profound impact on how we see the world. Those who write and direct films are our cultural narrators. The stories they tell shape our worldviews. Given that the majority of white people live in racial isolation from people of color, and black people in particular, and have very few authentic cross-racial relationships, white people are deeply influenced by the racial messages in films. Consider one statistic from the preceding list. Of the 100 top-grossing films worldwide in 2016, 95 were directed by white Americans, 99 of them by men. That is an incredibly homogeneous group of directors. Because these men are most likely at the top of the social hierarchy in terms of race, class, and gender, they are the least likely to have a wide variety of authentic, egalitarian, cross-racial relationships. Yet, they are in the position to represent the racial other. Their representations of the other are thereby extremely narrow and problematic, and yet they are reinforced over and over. Further, these biased representations have been disseminated worldwide. While white supremacy originated in the West, it circulates globally. White resistance to the term white supremacy prevents us from examining how these messages shape us. explicit white supremacists understand this. Christian Piccolini, a former white nationalist, explains that white nationalists recognized that they had to distance themselves from the terms racist and white supremacy to gain broader appeal. He describes the alt-right and white nationalist movements as the culmination of a 30-year effort to massage the white supremacist message. We recognized back then that we were turning away the average American white racists, and that we needed to look and speak more like our neighbors. The idea we had was to blend in, normalize, make the message more palatable. Derek Black, godson of David Duke and former key youth leader in the white nationalist movement, explains, "My whole talk was the fact that you could run as Republicans and say things like, we need to shut down immigration, we need to fight affirmative action, we need to end globalism. And you could win these positions, maybe, as long as you didn't get outed as a white nationalist and get all the controversy that comes along with it." Today's white nationalists are not the first to recognize the importance of distancing oneself from more explicit expressions of white supremacy. In a 1981 interview, Lee Atwater, Republican political strategist and advisor to Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, explained what came to be known as the Southern Strategy, how to appeal to the racism of white Southern voters without pronouncing it openly. You start out in 1954 by saying nigger, nigger, nigger. By 1968, you can't say nigger. That hurts you. Backfires. So you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. You're getting so abstract now that you're talking about cutting taxes. And all these things you're talking about are totally economic things. And a byproduct of them is that blacks get hurt worse than whites. And subconsciously, maybe that is part of it. But I'm saying that if it is getting that abstract and that coded, that we are doing away with the racial problem one way or the other. You follow me? Because obviously sitting around saying, we want to cut this, is much more abstract than even the busing thing, and a hell of a lot more abstract than nigger nigger. Our umbrage at the term white supremacy only serves to protect the processes it describes and obscure the mechanisms of racial inequality. Still, I understand that the term is very charged for many white people, especially older white people, who associate the term with extreme hate groups. However, I hope to have made clear that white supremacy is something much more pervasive and subtle than the actions of explicit white nationalists. White supremacy describes the culture we live in, a culture that positions white people and all that is associated with them, whiteness, as ideal. White supremacy is more than the idea that whites are superior to people of color. It is the deeper premise that supports this idea, the definition of whites as the norm or standard for human, and people of color as a deviation from that norm. Naming white supremacy changes the conversation in two key ways. It makes the system visible and shifts the locus of change onto white people, where it belongs. It also points us in the direction of the lifelong work that is uniquely ours, challenging our complicity with and investment in racism. This does not mean that people of color do not play a part, but that the full weight of responsibility rests with those who control the institutions. Sociologist Joe Feagin coined the term white racial frame to describe how whites circulate and reinforce racial messages that position whites as superior. In this way, the white racial frame rests on and is a key mechanism of white supremacy. The frame is deep and extensive, with thousands of stored bits. These bits are pieces of cultural information, images, stories, interpretations, omissions, silences, that are passed along from one person and group to the next, and from one generation to the next. The bits circulate, both explicitly and implicitly, for example, through movies, television, news, and other media, and stories told to us by family and friends. By constantly using the white racial frame to interpret social relations and integrating new bits, whites reinscribe the frame ever deeper. At the most general level, the racial frame views whites as superior in culture and achievement, and views people of color as generally of less social, economic, and political consequence. People of color are seen as inferior to whites in the making and keeping of the nation. At the next level of framing, because social institutions, education, medicine, law, government, finance, and the military are controlled by whites, white dominance is unremarkable and taken for granted. That whites are disproportionately enriched and privileged via these institutions is also taken for granted. We are entitled to more privileges and resources because we are better people. At the deepest level of the white frame, negative stereotypes and images of racial others as inferior are reinforced and accepted. At this level, corresponding emotions such as fear, contempt, and resentment are also stored. The frame includes both negative understandings of people of color and positive understandings of whites and white institutions. It is so internalized, so submerged, that it is never consciously considered or challenged by most whites. To get a sense of the white racial frame below the surface of your conscious awareness, think back to the earliest time that you were aware that people from racial groups other than your own existed. People of color recall a sense of always having been aware, while most white people recall being aware by at least age 5. If you lived in a primarily white environment, and are having trouble remembering, think about Disney movies, music videos, sports heroes, Chinese food, Aunt Jemima syrup, Uncle Ben's rice, the Taco Bell Chihuahua, Columbus Day, Apu from The Simpsons, and the donkey from Shrek. Reflect on these representations and ask yourself, did your parents tell you that race didn't matter and that everyone was equal? Did they have many friends of color? If people of color did not live in your neighborhood, why didn't they? Where did they live? What images, sounds, and smells did you associate with these other neighborhoods? What kind of activities did you think went on there? Were you encouraged to visit these neighborhoods, or were you discouraged from visiting these neighborhoods? What about schools? What made a school good? Who went to good schools? Who went to bad schools? If the schools in your area were racially segregated, as most schools in the United States are, why didn't you attend school together? If this is because you lived in different neighborhoods, why did you live in different neighborhoods? Were their schools considered equal to, better than, or worse than yours? If there was busing in your town, in which direction did it go? Who was bused into whose schools? Why did the busing go in one direction and not the other? If you went to school together, did you all sit together in the cafeteria? If not, why not? Were the honors or advanced placement classes and the lower track classes equally racially integrated? If not, why not? Now think about your teachers. When was the first time you had a teacher of the same race as yours? Did you often have teachers of the same race as your own? Most white people, in reflecting on these questions, realize that they almost always had white teachers. Many did not have a teacher of color until college. Conversely, most people of color have rarely, if ever, had a teacher who reflected their own races. Why is it important to reflect on our teachers in our effort to uncover our racial socialization and the messages we receive from schools? As you answer these questions, also consider which races were geographically closer to you than others. If your school was perceived as racially diverse, which races were more represented, and how did the racial distribution affect the sense of value associated with the school? For example, if white and Asian heritage students were the primary racial groups in your school, your school was likely to be seen as better than a school with more representation from Black and Latinx students. What were you learning about the racial hierarchy and your place in it from geography. If you lived and went to school in racial segregation, as most people in the United States do, you had to make sense of the incongruity between the claim that everyone was equal and the lived reality of segregation. If you lived in an integrated neighborhood and/or attended an integrated school, you had to make sense of the segregation in most of society outside the school, especially in segments considered of higher value or quality. It is also highly likely that there was still racial separation within the school. And for those of us who may have grown up in more integrated environments due to social class or changing neighborhood demographics, it is unlikely that integration has been sustained in our current lives. Reflection on these questions provides an entry point into the deeper messages that we all absorb and that shape our behavior and responses below the conscious level. In the U.S., race is encoded in geography. I can name every neighborhood in my city and its racial makeup. I can also tell you if a neighborhood is coming up or down in terms of home equity, and this will be based primarily on how its racial demographics are changing. Going up, it will be getting whiter. Going down, it will be getting less white. When I was a child, posters on my school walls and television shows like Sesame Street told me explicitly that all people were equal. But we simply do not live together across race. I had to make sense of this separation. If we were equal, why did we live separately? It must be normal and natural to live apart. Certainly no adult in my life was complaining about the separation. And at a deeper level, it must be righteous that we live apart, since we are better people. How did I get the message that we were better people? Consider how we talk about white neighborhoods. Good, safe, sheltered, clean, desirable. By definition, other spaces, not white, are bad, dangerous, crime-ridden, and to be avoided. These neighborhoods are not positioned as sheltered and innocent. In these ways, the white racial frame is under construction. Predominantly white neighborhoods are not outside of race. They are teeming with race. Every moment we spend in those environments reinforces powerful aspects of the white racial frame, including a limited worldview, a reliance on deeply problematic depictions of people of color, comfort in segregation, with no sense that there might be value in knowing people of color, and internalized superiority. In turn, our capacity to engage constructively across racial lines becomes profoundly limited. To illustrate an early lesson in white racial framing, imagine that a white mother and her white child are in the grocery store. The child sees a black man and shouts out, "Mommy, that man's skin is black." Several people, including the black man, turn to look. How do you imagine the mother would respond? Most people would immediately put their finger to their mouth and say, "Shush." When white people are asked what the mother might be feeling, most agree that she is likely to feel anxiety, tension, and embarrassment. Indeed, many of us have had similar experiences wherein the message was clear. We should not talk openly about race. When I use this example with my students, sometimes a student will say that the mother is just teaching her child to be polite. In other words, naming this man's race would be impolite. But why? What is shameful about being black? So shameful that we should pretend that we don't notice. The mother's reaction would probably be the same if the man had a visible disability of some kind, or was obese. But if the child had seen a white person and shouted out, "Mommy, that man's skin is white," it is unlikely that the woman would feel the same anxiety, tension, and embarrassment that would have accompanied the first statement. Now imagine that the child had shouted out how handsome the man was, or how strong. These statements would probably be met with chuckles and smiles. The child would not likely be shushed, because we consider these statements compliments. The example of a child publicly calling out a black man's race and embarrassing the mother illustrates several aspects of white children's racial socialization. First, children learn that it is taboo to openly talk about race. Second, they learn that people should pretend not to notice undesirable aspects that define some people as less valuable than others. A large birthmark on someone's face. A person using a wheelchair. These lessons manifest themselves later in life, when white adults drop their voices before naming the race of someone who isn't white. And especially so if the race being named is black. As if blackness were shameful, or the word itself were impolite. If we add all the comments we make about people of color privately when we are less careful, we may begin to recognize how white children are taught to navigate race. Chapter 3. Racism after the Civil Rights Movement. Children today are so open. When the old folks die off, we will finally be free of racism. I grew up in a small rural community, so I was very sheltered. I didn't learn anything about racism. I judge people by what they do, not who they are. I don't see color. I see people. We are all red under the skin. I marched in the 60s. New racism is a term coined by film professor Martin Barker to capture the ways in which racism has adapted over time so that modern norms, policies, and practices result in similar racial outcomes as those in the past, while not appearing to be explicitly racist. Sociologist Eduardo Bonilla Silva captures this dynamic in the title of his book, Racism Without Racists: Colorblind Racism and the Persistence of Racial Inequality in America. He says that though virtually no one claims to be racist anymore, racism still exists. How is that possible? Racism can still exist because it is highly adaptive. Because of this adaptability, we must be able to identify how it changes over time. For example, after a white nationalist march and the murder of a counter-protester, the President of the United States said that there are very fine people on both sides. This comment would have been unthinkable from a high-ranking public official just a few years ago. Yet if we asked the President if he was a racist, I am confident that he would reply with a resounding no. In fact, he recently stated that he was the least racist person one could ever meet. In this chapter, I review various ways that racism has adapted over time to continue to produce racial disparity while it exempts virtually all white people from any involvement in or benefit from racism. All systems of oppression are adaptive. They can withstand and adjust to challenges and still maintain inequality. Take, for instance, the federal recognition of same-sex marriage and accommodations for people with disabilities. While the overall systems of heterosexism and ableism are still with us, they have adapted in limited ways. These adaptations are held up as reassurance to those who fought long and hard for a particular change that equality has now been achieved. These milestones, such as the recognition of same-sex marriage, the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, Title IX, the election of Barack Obama, are, of course, significant and worthy of celebration. But systems of oppression are deeply rooted and not overcome with the simple passage of legislation. Advances are also tenuous, as we can see in recent challenges to the rights of LGBTQI, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer or questioning, and intersex people. Systems of oppression are not completely inflexible, but they are far less flexible than popular ideology would acknowledge, and the collective impact of the inequitable distribution of resources continues across history. Colorblind racism. What is termed colorblind racism is an example of racism's ability to adapt to cultural changes. According to this ideology, if we pretend not to notice race, then there can be no racism. The idea is based on a line from the famous I Have a Dream speech, given by Dr. Martin Luther King in 1963 during the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. At the time of King's speech, it was much more socially acceptable for white people to admit to their racial prejudices and belief in white racial superiority. But many white people had never witnessed the kind of violence to which blacks were subjected. Because the struggle for civil rights was